This episode is coming out just as I'm returning from co-presenting at a conference hosted by the Coalition of Oregon School Administrators, or COSA. And during our presentation, we talk about distinguishing between reform and transformation. That reform is usually made up of those outside forces really telling you what to do and coaching for compliance and using sticks and carrots to get results. And transformation is about establishing that why, or what we call the compelling purpose, asking Peter Senge's question, what do we want to create together? And it relies on cycles of inquiry and peer coaching and adjusting the goal when appropriate. It relies on appreciative inquiry. My guest today talks about one of the more challenging issues that urban school districts face, segregated schools. And in this case, in Louisville, Kentucky, the schools were integrated and were a successful model for the nation. Political interests forced a change, and my guest, Sheldon Berman, was the superintendent at the time. And in his words, there was this collective interest in retaining the best integrated school district, and yet that changed. I really encourage you to listen to his after-action review to learn what happened. It's an incredible story. I'm Peter Stiepelman, and this is An Imperfect Leader. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Dr. Sheldon Berman is my guest. Dr. Berman is a veteran superintendent, having served 28 years in Hudson and Andover, Massachusetts, and Jefferson County, which is Louisville, Kentucky, Eugene, Oregon. And during his tenure in Andover, for example, he launched a new strategic plan focused on innovation and authentic learning. And this included capstone projects for 5th, 8th, and 12th graders, and innovation labs and makerspaces, and a high school global network focused on the United Nations sustainability goals. And on January 1, 2021, Dr. Berman was appointed AASA's lead superintendent for social emotional learning. Dr. Berman, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Thank you, Peter. It's wonderful to be with you.
Now, Shelley, each month, you and two other leaders, you tackle these tough issues in AASA's Ethical Educator column, and I love that column. It's like reading the New York Times ethicist column. And in fact, you know, what I do is I consider how I might respond, and then I read how you and your colleagues respond. In fact, Dr. Nicastro was my commissioner when I was a superintendent in Missouri, so I know her a little bit. And we could spend our entire conversation discussing past situations, but today I would really like to talk about an article you wrote, Taking a Stand Against Divisive Concepts Laws. And I know this is deeply personal to you. For example, it was after reading that piece that I learned how you and your staff previously had developed an innovative elementary social studies program, One Community, One Nation. And it was a way to integrate social studies and literacy and the arts, all as vehicles for teaching community, culture, and civics at each grade level. And it was in your piece, Taking a Stand, and I will put a link in our show notes so that others can read it as well. You wrote this. You said, the goal of teaching about our history is not only to provide students with accurate information about our past, but also to demonstrate how we've made progress in overcoming injustices and in moving towards a more just society. Would you start with just telling us a little bit about what compelled you to write this piece?
I think we live right now in a very contentious and divisive environment, and that's particularly affecting school superintendents, particularly around divisive concept laws, and the way that is compromising quality teaching in terms of what teachers are able to say about race and about our history. It's also complicating administrators in terms of their support for those teachers. And what do they do when those teachers are challenged, and where do they stand? Now, I was a social studies teacher, and I have a very deep belief that children need accurate information. They need multiple perspectives, and they need to be able to think critically and openly about the topics that affect us in order for them to be effective citizens. And so as I was seeing these laws being passed, and hearing about teachers being fired. In fact, some of the complaints about teachers were really minor complaints about issues that I would say are really not the perspective of the majority of individuals. And so where do we stand when one individual is complaining about a teacher, yet most of those in the class feel that that teacher is doing a high quality job of introducing material that's important for students to know? I also believe that our history is not about just pain and suffering, as often portrayed in the run-up to the divisive concepts laws, but it's really about the progress we've made in human rights, in social justice, in franchising groups of people. It's a really powerful story about the progress of, in a sense, what a democracy can do to support individuals' engagement and support their well-being, and to limit that teaching in a way is very, I see it's very destructive to not only the individual student, but to our democracy as a whole.
I found myself at a dinner with a state board member who asked me about Florida's laws, particularly around the Don't Say Gay. So, I mean, everything you're talking about in terms of, divisive concepts laws around race, around class, certainly around gender, sexual orientation, and even religion. And so this individual asked me, how do you feel about I just don't think that kindergarten or third grade teachers should be talking about sexual orientation. And my response was, when I taught third grade, every morning we came together as a class, right? Now it's considered a best practice around restorative practices, but we had a class circle and we would just kind of do a quick check-in. And what happens when a child says, this weekend my mom's bought me a birthday present, and a child says, no, there are no two moms there, and teacher, can you tell us, there are no two moms, right? And at this point the board member's wife said, or two dads. I said, yeah, or two dads, exactly. I said, what happens when the teacher is posed with this sort of question, or is asked to sort of intervene and describe that families look very different all over the nation, all over the world? And if they're not allowed to say that, where do you think children are getting their information? The playground and the bus. I said, do you think that's the appropriate place for kids to be told? First of all, now you've just told that child, I can't talk about that, you should talk about that at home. You've just rejected that child in your classroom. And the biggest thing that we want is a relationship with our children in our classrooms. And so as I was reading your piece, I was thinking about that conversation, and I was thinking about exactly what you just said in terms of being able to take a step and look back on the progress we've made, which is a very different way that any of us sort of think about our history. We often think about what has gone wrong and what needs to be, highlighted or spotlit, as opposed to what has gone well in terms of our progress and how do we get more of it, right? A more appreciative lens to things. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, when opponents read your piece or have a conversation with you or listen to this podcast, they may say things like, learning our nation's history is really just an opportunity to make people feel guilty. And you talk a little bit about that. And I wonder, how do you respond, or what advice do you give to superintendents who are faced with this, you're just trying to make my child feel guilty?
Well, this is not about guilt, in fact. We don't own the acts of our ancestors. And it's to be really clear, we don't own those. But we do own what is the present consequences of that. And we do own the lessons that our history teaches us. And so it's important that we be clear that children need to know those things, because they need to know that we have made progress, but two, that we need never to do that again. And so whether it's, whether they're confronting our own laws or confronting laws that are being passed in other countries like Uganda right now around homosexuality, they need to know the progress we've made, and they need to know the struggle was for us to move to that place and what we stand for. Beyond anything else, I think what's so important for administrators to understand is that we have a set of values, and that as leaders, that creates an identity, not only for ourselves, but for our organizations. And the question is, do we want to be inclusive? Do we want to represent all the children who are with us? Do we want to ensure the success of all children? And do we want to ensure the success of our democracy? You know, the essential mission of public education is to enable a democracy to thrive. And if we are simply indoctrinating students in one particular political perspective, that it's destructive for all of us. You know, and some of the acts now that are moving forward, for example, in Florida, with some of the use of materials that are really far right-wing materials that are coming.
Right, this notion that important skills were learned because of slavery, as a result of slavery.
Exactly.
What an insulting and absolutely dismaying and destructive view of our history.
Exactly. And if that's, you know, that's an apologetic, apologetic view of slavery, you know, and so I think we have to confront that. And as leaders, we have a responsibility to speak to that. Now, you know, there was another piece that I did for school administrator called Reclaiming the Narrative. And the one thing that stood out most in for me about how do we confront this is that, first of all, most of the public really agrees that we have to teach our history accurately and unflinchingly and have to understand what the mistakes were of the past and how we attempted to correct those. And that most people actually want an inclusive, respectful community in our schools. They want their children to be cared about. So, for example, the attacks on social emotional learning. People don't understand that we're educating children socially, emotionally, no matter what we do, every day in the classroom. So we want to create the most constructive environment. So what we need to be able to articulate is what's the common core of what we want to achieve. For example, in terms of equity, we want all kids to be successful. In terms of social emotional learning, we want to create environments where all children can feel safe and protected. In terms of inclusivity, we want our children to feel that they are loved, cared about, accepted. These are basic things that the vast majority of people agree with. And it's our role as superintendents and as leaders, principals, other leaders and systems to be able to articulate that core message so that people will say, oh, I get it. I understand what you're trying to do. And not get involved in the tit for tat kind of debates that, you know, could have happened at the dinner table with your board member that you talked about earlier.
In my book and in the leadership model that I use to advise others, there's a dimension. Collective aspiration is what it's called. And that's really the heart of an organization's work. And inside that dimension, there's a term, an ethic of excellence. And an ethic of excellence speaks to Ron Berger's lifetime of documenting the process of learning. And it documents progress. And for example, as superintendents, we'd love to see the final product on a bulletin board or a display case. And unlike a museum, we're interested in the process, the journey taken to create that final product. And I felt like you were speaking to an ethic of excellence in your piece when you advocated for a school's role in helping young people become knowledgeable and responsible citizens in our democratic society. Those were your words. And I guess I'm curious what advice you might have for leaders who are seeking to demonstrate principled leadership.
It's a great question. The one thing that I would share, the one piece of advice that I would share is that there's no right way to do the wrong thing. You know, we often think about what's expedient in the situation. What will get us through this situation without necessarily thinking of what's the right thing to do in the situation, or what's the politically viable thing to do in a situation, when actually political viability may be essentially consenting to things that really violate our ethics and values. And then sometimes we confuse means and ends, and so that and think that the ends justify the means. And so that what we have to come back to is saying, where do we stand? What values do we hold dear? And what values are we going to, as a principled leader, we have to stand on principles. Now, we can do it in not a, sort of a pedantic way or dictatorial way of these are my principles and you have to agree with those. We have to do it in a way that articulates those principles clearly so that people understand and do it in a way that's respectful of other people's opinions. The other thing that often gets confused in these debates is that people think that we're teaching children what to think. And that's just not the case. We're teaching children how to think and how to debate, how to critically analyze situations. And so we use different perspectives to do that. What we have to be most concerned about is that we're not indoctrinating. And as a social studies teacher, I think my students never knew what party I belonged to, and because I would represent multiple perspectives. And that's quality teaching, although, even there were certain situations where I say, this is the principles that I hold dear. You don't say there's two perspectives on racism or two perspectives on whether the Holocaust happened. And, we've come to, people believing things that are just really extraordinary and almost cultish in the kinds of conspiracy theories that people hold and the attitudes that they're bringing forward into the public space. And it is our responsibility to say, no, that's not accurate, and to represent what we know as truth. And that may be controversial in certain situations, but it calls on us to stand on what is truth and what principles we hold dear. I think that in doing that, we reclaim what's so vital and important. And it's that ethic of excellence that you talk about. The excellent teaching is teaching that complicates students' thinking, so they won't accept simple answers to complicated problems. I mean, that is the art of teaching.
How does the term an imperfect leader resonate with you?
Well, I think we all are imperfect leaders. We're all imperfect individuals, frankly. And it's the humility to understand that I think it makes us human. It is so important. There are so many mistakes that I think I've made in my superintendencies, or so many times when I've been confronted with things that issues that I said, I'm not sure which is the right way to go. And we have to be open to our own learning. So the imperfect leader, I think it's a wonderful concept, Peter, and I'm glad you're framing it in that way, because that enables us to learn, enables us to grow as leaders.
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being, and I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of an imperfect leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of An Imperfect Leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. My guest is Dr. Sheldon Berman, a veteran superintendent having served 28 years in Massachusetts and Kentucky and in Oregon, and is currently serving as AASA's lead superintendent for social emotional learning. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they've made in their past, and then we discuss it. So Shelley, what happened?
Well, the one I've selected for this our discussion is one that I think I really struggled with a great deal. When I first became superintendent in Louisville, actually, in fact, even before I became superintendent in Louisville, I visited the district as part of the interviews. I went to the newspaper. I interviewed with the editors of the Courier Journal. I obviously interviewed with the board, interviewed with administrators, community members. There was a collective interest in retaining what had essentially become the best integrated urban school district in the country. And the Chamber of Commerce, which is called Greater Louisville, Inc., had a deep investment in retaining a integrated school system because they thought this was the economic vitality of Louisville. It enabled people to get along. It enabled us to break the cycles of poverty. There was a real common agreement.
And isn't there just a ton of research that suggests that when children are also integrated in terms of not just racial sort of integration, but also class, that there's a sort of a lifting up of all because there are opportunities that previously may not have existed?
That's right. In fact, the research is very deep and has continued in spite of the trends to resegregate in practically every school district in the country.
Right.
And so the research says one thing, but we are actually moving in a very different direction. In fact, 2 days before I became officially superintendent, the Supreme Court issued a decision that essentially said that the student assignment plan, which is the desegregation plan in Louisville, was unconstitutional. And it was a black and other classification. And so the school district had actually developed a plan around specifically integrating black children into white schools and white children into black schools. So that was the previous plan. With it being unconstitutional, actually, the Supreme Court Justice Kennedy gave us a narrow window to look at multiple dimensions. And so in the first year, we had a team of about 20 people gathered together, including five attorneys, some who had been in front of the Supreme Court, to hammer out a new plan. And we actually hammered out a plan that was, in fact, even more effective at promoting integration than the original plan. And the year after I left, and the 2 years after I left, in fact, the district issued reports that showed that the level of integration had improved significantly. However, it became a hot political issue. The Supreme Court didn't resolve the issue in a sense. Those who were antagonistic to the plan found other ways to bring us to court and then found other ways to create tensions in the community. It became a topic in the mayoral race, even though we were independent of the city. We even had an independent tax base. But the mayor, we had a mayoral race in which one of the candidates was saying, we're going to go back to neighborhood schools. We had a governor's race where the president of the Senate was running on, we're going to pass laws to go back to neighborhood schools. So it became hotly contested. And the board, the school board in Louisville or in Jefferson County, shifted in its opinion. And in my last year, they basically indicated that they wanted to abandon the plan. Even one of the state senators came up to me and said, we love what you're doing, but you have to let go of desegregation. And so looking at the direction that the board was going, looking at the my own values around this, I did not want to have the disassembling of and resegregation, disassembling of a student assignment plan that promoted integration and the resegregation of Louisville on my watch. I believe that we had done the right thing and that this was not the direction I could take the district. We tried a modest revision that might have made some difference, but both the board rejected that and the community was not as inclined to support it. And so we came to an agreement and I left the district, even though that was probably one of the most exciting and most energizing positions I had ever been in. But sometimes, you know, when you stand for your values, you have to let go of some of the things that you'd like to do when things are going in a different way.
So many superintendents across the nation are doing the right work, the good work, the important work, and sometimes their beliefs and their principles and their values, they find themselves at odds with the political climate, and sometimes a board that has shifted. Even the board that hired them is no longer the board they currently have, or the board has shifted in their thinking based on their desire to retain their positions, and so the community begins to push them in a different direction. And it sounds like for you, you had to live exactly what we talked about earlier, this idea of being a principled leader, one that remains firm and anchored to a set of beliefs, principles, and values. And so you've had some time between that event and now where you are today. What would you say was overlooked as you look back on this experience?
Well, you know, you can't sometimes anticipate what's going to go wrong. And when I look back on it, I wonder whether there was some better plan initially that we could have come up with and some rethinking around our planning. You know, there are so many compromises made in urban education. And although in the end, I believe we did the right thing. You know, the school district hired a new superintendent who had been an assistant superintendent who essentially had disassembled the student assignment plan, the desegregation plan in Wake County. And she proposed a plan, and that has essentially diminished the level of integration significantly in Louisville and in Jefferson County's public schools. So the direction was set in that, and I'm not sure I could have done more. But what I wish I had done is had deeper conversations earlier and looked for where were the points where we may have made adjustments earlier. The other thing is I really went out and campaigned for integration near the end. And I think with the thought that maybe I could convince the board and maybe I could convince the community that this was, that we were headed in the right direction. And I may have convinced the community to some degree, but I think the board felt that this was something that they politically could not take on. You know, in my next school district in Eugene, the board chair at one point turned to me when we were having this debate, public debate about, actually it was a math curriculum. And he said, when you're defending, you're losing. And it's always stayed with me since then that we shouldn't be defending. We need to be either listening or really sharing what we believe and what we hold dear and why we believe that that's important. But too often we close off too early. And that's probably the lesson that I drew out of this, that the tensions nationwide around integration and desegregation and the tensions right now around race are resurfacing again. And we have to realize that this is not going away. This is something that we're going to have to navigate for the rest of our lives and the rest of the life of the country, in spite of the fact that we all want a society free of racism.
What did you learn about relationships, or what new relationships were formed?
I feel like people looked up to the courage that I showed in that circumstance. That it wasn't, for me, it wasn't about a job. It was about a mission to improve the quality of education and the lives of children. And the people who responded to that really appreciated that I stood up for that spirit, that mission of education, and appreciated that somebody was able to articulate, you know, why it was so important.
What frustrated you?
Well, you know, you always want to come out on the winning end on these things. And so, you know, I have to say, you know, at first the board, my contract was up. The board voted not to renew my contract. And then after we'd recommended some changes to the student assignment plan, there was going to be a reconsideration. I knew I probably actually had probably a 4-3 vote in my favor. And I said, no, I think that it's better if I move on. It's too divisive. So, you know, in terms of the relationships, yeah, I valued the relationships that I established, the work that we did, the collaboration with people. You know, urban education is a real challenge, and it's something that people don't realize how passionate the leaders in public education of urban school districts, how passionate they are about children. And not just the superintendent, it's all the way down. When I would go into schools in Louisville, some of the highest poverty schools, the teachers were so committed. I felt honored to be working with them. You know, the sense of mission. And we don't often realize that. We have sometimes such a negative view of urban education. You know, and what we've realized about kids is that we need to build on assets rather than, you know, continually trying to fix the kid. We need to fix the environment rather than fixing the kid. And in the large scale work in terms of politics of urban education is about fixing the school district rather than saying, what are the assets that people are bringing here and how can we build on those assets and strengthen the system? And that's what I felt we were trying to do. We were creating environments that supported children in the best way that we could find to support their well-being and their success and their family success. And, you know, I still have to say Louisville is a great school district. You know, some of the reforms that not only we put in place, but some of the reforms that were put in place before I got there were wonderful ways to support children and support families. And it actually, you know, it's a wonderful community. So I don't hold any, you know, I would have loved to have been more successful there, but frankly, it was a wonderful place. And I still have cherished memories and know that there are many people doing profoundly good work in that school district.
In the end, while this was something you look back on and wish there had been more success, every experience that a superintendent has teaches them something that they take to their next job or to their next post, to their next opportunity. What was something that was good that came out of this situation?
You know, what came out, well, that's a great question. You know, what came out for me in this was the understanding of how important an integrated school system is. How important it is that we understand how to get along with people who are different from us. And that, you know, whether it's the housing patterns that have prevented more of an integrated society or our school systems or our laws, I think what I came away with and what I think the community came away with in some ways is the sense that we do need to get along. We do need to have a more humane approach to each other.
My guest again today was Dr. Sheldon Berman, former superintendent and currently AASA's lead superintendent for social emotional learning. And Shelley, I've been really looking forward to this conversation. And you know, so often superintendents are caught between two camps. Either they're told that they're moving too fast, or that they're told that they're not moving fast enough. And rarely do we stop and sort of remark on the progress we've made and use that as encouragement. You said a couple of things today that really resonated for me. The fact that there are no simple answers to complex situations or questions. And more than that, that there's such an importance for leaders to recognize this idea of principled leadership, that they have principles, values, and beliefs that they must anchor themselves to, and recognize that the success of our democracy depends on their ability to bring lots of people in and to really recognize and listen to the different perspectives and then make the very best decisions always for children. So thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. It was wonderful doing this.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print inspired Daruma Dal butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.